KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law and affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. And this year, a visiting research collaborator at Princeton Center for Information Technology Policy. Welcome to the inaugural fall 2015 quarter edition of Hearsay Culture. We're back after a somewhat longer hiatus over the summer as I was focusing on writing projects and other stuff involving advocacy, as well as spending time as much as I could with family. But we're back at it on Hearsay Culture. I'm excited today to start off our fall quarter with Professor Andrea Medwishan of Northeastern University School of Law and a former Microsoft visiting professor at Princeton CITP. And I guess I should say we are colleagues because we are both visiting research collaborators at Princeton CITP this semester and this perhaps this year. And Andrea is on the show today after having spent a lot of time, I think, over the last several years, we've chatted about a variety of projects that Andrea works on. But we're going to focus today on the recent news, and we are recording on September 25th, 2015, for air the following week. The recent news that came out this week involving Volkswagen and their efforts to use code to circumvent federal regulations in the United States under the Clean Air Act to allow their cars to operate outside the scope of what the maximum emissions are in the U.S., using code that was designed directly to thwart regulation. This code, which is now been written about extensively, but the story is still early, allowed Volkswagen diesel cars to, when they were being tested for emissions, to turn on the systems that would allow the emissions to be sufficient or not sufficient for purposes of how the car ran, and allow it to pass, and then the moment that the car leaves the testing operation, it goes back to running without those procedures in place, allowing it to have greater efficiency, but of course create more damage to the environment. This story is one that continues to develop, and as we're recording today on Friday, September 25th, news just in the last couple of days had the CEO of Volkswagen stepping down. In fact, just earlier today, I saw news that the new head of Volkswagen is the head of their Porsche unit. But we're going to be focusing today on Andrea's work, which actually now becomes even more important in this space. Andrea has been active in a variety of capacities, including at the Federal Trade Commission, focusing on consumer protection issues, as well as questions of what information can be accessed by security researchers. And anyone who listens to Hearsay Culture regularly or indeed reads blogs like Freedom to Tinker or the CIS blog that Stanford runs knows that the questions of how researchers can access the data and code and information that they need to do their jobs is a very complex one. Standing at the center of that issue, and particularly relevant here, is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, Section 1201, as well as what are known as technological protection measures. And those measures themselves are designed to, in theory, protect the copyright interest of code owners, but in fact also make it difficult for security researchers to do their jobs. And this is relevant to this story because it turns out that we, the public, know about these issues involving Volkswagens, which now indicates that at least 11 million cars are at issue. We know about this because of researchers, academic researchers at West Virginia University, who identified this issue. And now, as a result of that independent outside research, the Environmental Protection Agency is taking action. So we're going to have a very interesting and timely discussion today with Andrea about not only the Volkswagen issue, but also the DMCA and her very recent and ongoing work to get the Copyright Office to perhaps create an exemption for the kind of research that resulted in this information becoming known, but also more broadly in allowing greater research on a variety of areas. So I will allow Andrea to introduce herself in more detail. Suffice to say that I'm thrilled to have her on the show. Again, we are recording on September 25th, 2015. Andrea is joining us via Skype, I assume from Boston, but I could be wrong. Andrea, thank you.
I'm actually in Chicago.
In Chicago. Okay, very good. Yeah. Well, Andrea, thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
It's my pleasure.
So let me do this, Andrea, because you've done a lot of work in this space and you have a really interesting career. Why don't you tell listeners a bit more about yourself and how you became interested in this particular issue?
Sure. Of course, my favorite topic for conversation, my own research and my career. So I sort of started in this field as a practicing corporate attorney, and it was really my clients in the late 90s and early 2000s that reached out for counsel with respect to data security issues and let me into the realities of their challenges in securing customer and proprietary information. And that sparked my interest in this space, and I was doing licensing and deals for technology entrepreneurs and Fortune 500 companies, working in tech as well and outside of tech. And the technologies just became more complex and the security issues became more fascinating. And I find myself 15 or so years later straddling the world between the business aspects of technology, legal challenges in security, and the research community that is generating the information that leads to future regulatory action and is at the crux of building the next generation of products that our safety and even our lives in some cases will depend upon. And so these are the bundle of issues that I research. So questions of technology, entrepreneurship, and innovation as they relate to information security and privacy. And the iteration that you've mentioned with the DMCA is one of the latest sets of projects that I have found myself engaged with and will continue to work on.
So, Andrea, you've said exactly what I say to my students when I introduce myself, which is that I love talking about myself, and who doesn't? And so I am going to ask you to talk even more about yourself here, because there is even, I think, more to say. I mentioned very quickly your prior experience with the Federal Trade Commission. Perhaps you could talk about that and how it colors your current work, and perhaps just to set the context of my introduction before we dive into the DMCA and the Volkswagen story, tell us a bit about some of those other projects.
Sure. So as you've mentioned, I've worn many hats over the years. In 2014, I had the honor of serving as the Federal Trade Commission Senior Policy Advisor and Academic in Residence, where I focused my efforts on security and privacy issues. And so that allowed me the unique opportunity to see from the inside how some of the enforcement activity and the broader dynamics on the policy side in DC are evolving around questions of code integrity and information security. The FTC, of course, has been perhaps the most active agency with respect to information security enforcement, having brought over 50 enforcement actions against various companies for a failure to meet the standard of reasonable security. And they've also recently released a helpful website and set of documents around the notion of starting with security, encouraging companies to read through that information and double check their own enterprises for the basic level of reasonable security measures that every enterprise should have in place at this juncture. And it's a helpful document that certainly bolsters the arguments that we saw recently with the Third Circuit and the Wyndham decision, validating the FTC's appropriate enforcement authority under Section 5 of the FTCA, the Fair Trade Practices Act, which was challenged by Wyndham Hotels.
So let me ask you this, Andrew, before we dive in, just a couple more setup questions, particularly for people that don't focus on these issues heavily. You know, the Federal Trade Commission is one very important federal administrative entity that works in this space. If we're thinking about broadly the Volkswagen story, and I'll really ask you in a moment to kind of give me your version of the salient facts to the extent that they vary from mine. What are the other entities primarily that would overlap or would work with the FTC to deal with the problem like Volkswagen and emissions?
The combination of regulatory entities that would be interested in a case like this will vary based on the industry that the particular company is functioning within. So in the case of, say, a publicly traded company in the United States, obviously the Securities and Exchange Commission would immediately take note of any sort of a major business hiccup, such as the one that we're talking about in Volkswagen's case, because, of course, the accurate reporting of projected risks and material business impacts that happen on an annualized basis in 10-Ks for public companies, that content needs to be accurately disclosed. And the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission in particular, has also started to voice concern over the insufficiency of disclosure with respect to information security / cybersecurity practices and security incidents that companies are experiencing. In October of 2011, the Securities and Exchange Commission released its first guidance on this topic. It has since subsequently released additional guidance on information security topics. And so the SEC is one of the key agencies to keep an eye out for. But really, the questions of information security permeate every industry and every aspect of regulatory interest. And so you will have a large number of agencies engaged in some aspect of a company's day-to-day information security practices, whether it is FTC or the SEC or the EPA or DHS trying to be helpful, or the FBI investigating the consequences of a breach, or perhaps the IRS will step in some way to analyze the appropriateness at some future point of tax credits in this space, which is something that I think would be a great move for them. There really is a panoply of interests that impact businesses and agencies. And of course, because we know from the OPM breach that data vulnerability and software integrity problems are certainly not limited to the private sector, we have a highlighting in both sides of this discussion, in the private and the public sector, of the importance of having security throughout an enterprise, whether it's an agency or a private company. And having the capacity to lead by example is something that I certainly hope more government agencies will continue to prioritize in their own structures, as they work with the private sector to bolster security throughout our economy. Because, of course, information is only as secure as the weakest link. And the line between public and private in terms of our national security is sometimes very slippery.
It's a fascinating area that, obviously, just based upon that answer, we could spend the next several hours just trying to pick this apart, and we won't. But we will spend a little bit of time. Andrea, let me. And we're chatting with Andrea Medwishian on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Let's define a few terms here, Andrea, as we dig into only, you know, certainly a high profile, but only the most recent example of how IP law and copyright intersect with access information and regulation. I mentioned the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, but for those that aren't familiar, what is it and what were its design goals?
So the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA, shifted the precedent constraints of copyright law to ideally recognize, in Congress's mind, some of the unique challenges that digital content presented. And so for purposes of our discussion today, I think the operative shift is one that that is embodied in the statute, where the circumvention of a copy protection measure on digital content itself became a problematic act. So even though from perhaps a technological standpoint, one would say that is mere preparation and doesn't demonstrate necessarily an act of copying, in the way that the statute is crafted, it is that mere preparation, that act of circumvention under Section 1201 of the DMCA, that is itself problematic, legally speaking. And of course, the DMCA comes with not only possible civil consequences, but criminal consequences as well. And so, as you excellently pointed out, what we're seeing now is that as technology has marched on, as we are no longer in the 90s and we are many years in the future from that point and our world looks substantially different, despite Congress's good intentions in the DMCA, including setting up every three-year updating process for the Copyright Office and the Library of Congress to consider exemptions to the DMCA, what we're seeing is that a progressing tension is sometimes arising between the language and the initial framing of the DMCA and other policy areas, security being one of them. And so in this round of DMCA proposed exemptions, we see a focus on not only unlocking requests, which we saw in prior rounds, but we also see focus on security in particular and the right to research the integrity of code in order to verify the safety of its functionality for the benefit of consumers and users of that code.
And this is where this issue, I think, becomes surprising for people that don't focus on this regularly. Because normally you wouldn't think of copyright as making it difficult for people to do research. You know, by virtue of the name of the law, copyright is supposed to actually prevent unauthorized copying. And so with that in mind, tell us a bit about technological protection measures and what they are and how they fit into the DMCA, which therefore leads to how they impact researchers.
Sure. And in fact, it is precisely that term, technological protection measure, as discussed in the statute, that leads to some of the confusion around what is legally permissible, what is not legally permissible. That term, technological protection measure, is a legal term of art. It doesn't cleanly map onto the technology constructs that, in particular, security researchers encounter when they are attempting to analyze a particular code base and look for flaws that could result in a serious negative outcome in even in physical space in the context of, say, a car that has flawed code that could result in random acceleration or brake failure, etc. And so what we see here is well-intentioned Congress members and attorneys creating a term, technological protection measure, that isn't tightly connected to the realities of technology as experienced or understood by the people who are doing this research. So in a nutshell, what's happening is an perhaps not entirely foreseeable consequence of this statutory framework. And so what's happening is that when a researcher uncovers a flaw in copyright-protected code, that researcher will often contact the company or the creator of that code and extend a hand and say, hey, we found a flaw, vulnerability, imperfection in your code that could have negative consequences. Can we help you fix it, or will you please fix it? And the sophisticated technology-engaged companies today receive one of those reports and say, thank you, we will advise you of how our process is proceeding. They acknowledge the receipt of the information within 7 days. And in many cases, they even financially reward the researcher through a bug bounty. However, we're at this growing pains stage in our economy where not all companies react favorably to receiving information about an error, a code flaw, a vulnerability in the code that they are using or have written. Now, let me just take a step back. Having a mistake in your code, an error in your code, is not necessarily an act of malice or an act of cheating. It can be simply an oversight, the same way that a lawyer might write a memo and include an extra comma or misspell a word that spell check doesn't catch. These types of errors happen partially because code is written by humans for humans. It's a human-created work, and there will always be room for error. And so it's only through thorough vetting, not only internally, but also sometimes external eyes are required, because not everything is always caught internally. And having confidence in the quality of your code and being receptive to critique and improvement of your code, everyone wins in that case, because the owners of the code, the creators of the code, end up with a better product, and they instill confidence in their customers and in the market that they are receptive to and will correct errors. And the consumers in this case win, because of course they end up with more secure products that are less likely to harm them in some way. Now, unfortunately, not every company responds positively to these reports. And when companies respond negatively, their attorneys generally resort to a standard toolkit of legal threats. Those legal threats generally revolve around the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, trade secret law, and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, Section 1201 circumvention. And so when a researcher receives that bundle of threats, that can be very disconcerting, and it's intended, I would expect, putting myself in the shoes of the attorneys who are drafting these letters, to pointedly encourage the researcher to go away and stop talking about the problems that exist in this code. Now, the problem with that is that it's not merely one annoying researcher finding a problem and being a thorn in the side of the company. What that researcher is actually doing is acting as the canary in the coal mine, pointing out something that undoubtedly malicious attackers have probably already found or will soon find. And so it's not a question of just one researcher knowing something annoying for the creator of the code. It's that researcher giving a heads up to allow the creator of the code adequate time to attempt to address the flaws before that code is attacked in a far more serious way by outside malicious third parties. But having the confidence in your organizational structure and the sophistication of knowledge to understand that security through obscurity, denying the existence of flaws, never works as a winning business strategy. Having the sophistication and confidence as an organization to adopt that correct model is unfortunately something that not every corporate enterprise has grown into yet. We still don't have members of the board of directors in all cases having technology expertise. We still don't necessarily have a member of the board of directors with security expertise inside companies. And when we look at some of the major compromises that we've seen, whether it be the Sony compromise or others, we see that corporate America is still getting itself up to speed with the state of the art of best practices in corporate management of structures around code integrity. And so what this DMCA process is reflecting, it's a request. In my case, I'm acting as the attorney for Class 25, which is a group of researchers, some of the leading academic researchers that do computer security from University of Pennsylvania and University of Michigan and Columbia and initially from Princeton. I was at Princeton at the time. We have this request that is asking for the Copyright Office to basically provide for a safety net for these researchers, that when they attempt to disclose the existence of this flaw, or they are researching the existence of this flaw, that act of trying to further the state of the art of security knowledge to make everyone safer is not a potentially criminal violation of the DMCA. And so that's the crux of our request. And it's really straightforward in that way when you think about it. It's purely a request to have the Copyright Office validate the assertion that code integrity matters. Having code that can potentially kill people and not being willing to fix it is not something that copyright law is intended to protect. And creating this conversation, facilitating this conversation among helpful researchers trying to make us all safer and responsible companies trying to further their code quality in order to minimize their own liability potentially down the road for accidentally harming people when an oversight happens in the way that they have written this code. Now, in the case of an intentionally poorly written code base, perhaps such as the one that we have at issue in Volkswagen, which based on EPA reports, it appears that they have admitted to intentionally authoring the code in that manner. Based on one EPA report that I reviewed on the internet, that report stated that there was a stipulation by Volkswagen agents that, in fact, the code was written intentionally that way. In that kind of a circumstance, as a researcher is reviewing the code base, the researcher may discover that not only accidentally written code exists, but poorly written code that may potentially maliciously alter some sort of functionality. So it is entirely possible that had researchers felt confident enough to analyze the code base inside these cars, they may have noticed that the code was working strangely, and researchers may have more quickly on the code analysis side identified an abnormal set of code functions that then would have led to further inquiry and potentially uncovered this defeat mechanism structure more quickly than the emissions testing-based research, which was obviously pivotal and instrumental to getting us to the point that we're at today. But code analysis would have also been potentially a useful tool in this kind of a circumstance that may have also detected abnormal code functions inside these cars.
We're chatting with Professor Andrea Metwishin of Northeastern University School of Law and KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it is on KZSU, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu or go to our website and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen. So Andrew, you said a lot there in that last answer, and I wanted to unpack a few things from what you said. When we're thinking about security researchers, the examples that we have here and that we've talked about so far are academics. But is that community broader? In other words, when we think about who's impacted by the DMCA, and I want to come back to those impacts in a second, what is the world of security research? Who are those people?
Security research is indeed broader than just academic security researchers. When we speak about security researchers, we're actually talking about the community of people who have the skills to uncover or analyze code to find flaws. For example, at a consultancy called Rapid7 in Boston, one of their employees is a researcher named Mark Stanislav, who has used his free time as a public service to analyze the code in various baby monitors. And he took nine leading baby monitors and analyzed the quality of security and privacy protection that they provide to their customers. And he did this partially because of his own personal experiences in gifting one of these things to his family and then realizing, hey, maybe he should check the quality of the code. And then to his horror discovered that he had gifted a baby monitor that he deemed to be completely untrusted and accessible by third parties potentially from the outside. We see the FTC engaging in enforcement activity against a company called TrendNet for their vulnerable baby monitors. And in this most recent research, Mark discovered that the average quality of privacy and security on these best-selling baby monitors was at best, I believe his highest grade was a D or a D minus. And what this means functionally, and if you Google for baby monitor and hacker or attack or compromise or privacy, you'll unearth a number of stories of malicious third parties on the internet talking at babies in their cribs and sometimes doing things like playing the police song Every Breath You Take, followed by obscene noises. And this problem has existed not only in the last year, but you can find stories dating back 3-4 years at least around this type of low quality code in some of these baby monitors that allows for third parties to access the intimate space of a baby's room and not only listen in on what's happening in that room and infuse the room with their own malicious voices and sounds. But also, if you think about the way that the Internet of Things allows these devices to be connected to home networks, that baby monitor is more than just a baby monitor. It is a portal. It is an entry point into the home network, which then can also be an entry point into other networks that any user on that home network connects with. So, crazy as it sounds, a compromised baby monitor with weak security may indirectly at some point lead to a work network getting compromised because the attacker came in through the baby monitor and ended up on the corporate network because the attacker was watching the conduct and recording the passwords, et cetera, to allow for access into that corporate network. And so it's bad enough that the sanctity of a baby's crib is being violated in this case by third parties that are clearly problematic criminals. But on top of that, we have a security concern that goes beyond the confines of the home into our economy more broadly. And so each device, as part of the Internet of Things that we connect to our networks, it's another point of possible vulnerability, another entry point into these treasure troves of information that attackers yearn to find. And so security researchers like Mark, like the academics who donated their time to collaborate with me on this exemption request, just like those academics, researchers like Mark recognize the importance to our long-term success as an economy and the integrity of the trust and code that exists within the purchasing world, where consumers buy products they're trusting with the most intimate details of their lives. But once some of these products start betraying them, their confidence is going to get eroded, and our internet economy as a whole, our technology economy and technology entrepreneurship will suffer as a result. And so this is a big picture problem with lots of points of entry, but at its most succinct, basic level, there are researchers who are donating their time because they think it's really problematic that third parties can torment children, for example, but also they think it's really problematic and they're worried about the integrity of the market as a whole once these Internet of Things entry points start to be exploited in large numbers to access the broader data structures that are the crown jewels of companies and our economy. And the number of devices that we're putting online in the Internet of Things is going to skyrocket over the next 5 years. The estimates are in the billions. And those devices tend to have significantly worse security in place than our PCs or even our phones. And so these internet entrepreneurs who are creating these neat gadgets for the Internet of Things are helping make our lives more convenient, more interesting, and more engaging, and the gadgets are great. But helping to make them as secure as possible, that needs to be one of the key, if not the starting point, for their own assessments of the qualities of their products, and working with security researchers who uncover these code flaws in their products in a collaborative, constructive way, so that no more children end up with strange third parties playing creepy music at them in their beds. That was the sort of issue that we're dealing with when we're proposing this exemption to protect security researchers in their good faith attempts to report and collaborate to help companies fix their own vulnerabilities.
We're chatting with Andrea Mitwishin on KZSFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. I mean, Andrea, you're passionate about this work, and for good reason. Let me ask you a couple of follow-up questions here. You know, to be clear, when we're thinking about this VW story, and you alluded to it earlier in your previous answer, but I want to come back to it. All right, based upon what we know, did those researchers at West Virginia University violate the DMCA and or the CFAA and or some kind of misappropriation of trade secrets? I mean, recognize I'm not asking you for a legal opinion, and we can put all the caveats in there. But your sense of this story, are they the kinds in their activities, did they potentially run afoul of the law?
I'm not sure what research methodologies they used in particular. They did testing in the field, and the way that the EPA connected with their research, which is a process that happens regularly, especially now that, for example, the Federal Trade Commission is usefully sending representatives to security conferences. EPA officials attended an academic conference where these researchers presented their work. And so that kind of a presentation of work is precisely itself the kind of expression that copyright presumably is intended to protect, to create additional copyrightable works in the space and to exchange ideas and protect the expression of ideas as embedded in tangible media by these researchers. And so agencies are increasingly cooperating with researchers. But when threats using the DMCA have been levied by companies, it is very often to prevent precisely that kind of a conference presentation, like the one that the West Virginia researchers engaged in, that EPA officials were in attendance for, which ultimately led to the EPA inquiry, which uncovered the presence of the defeat mechanisms. So although I'm not familiar with the exact methodology that the West Virginia researchers used, the processes and the points of possible legal leverage that are the inspiration for our DMCA exemption, those leverage points certainly existed in that particular presentation.
Now, let me be clear. I want to push back only to the extent that we understand what's going on here, because the story and the arguments you make seem rather compelling. And yet, as you pointed out at the beginning of the show, right, the Copyright Office goes through a triennial process to have exemptions granted, which means that the law as written at some level was intending to make this kind of work not as simple. Why would it be that a company dealing with a security risk would want to stop not the publication, where we could, and we, if we had more time, we could get into the debate about security through transparency, but why would they want to stop the research? In other words, you know, paint for me, if you will, the counter argument for the DMCA as it currently exists. What would be the business or policy rationale for maintaining the law as it is, and therefore keeping these technological protection measures, subject to all of the flaws that you've pointed out, in place? Is there at least a rational basis for their position?
Let me just back up a touch and push back on your question a little bit.
Okay.
and then address it, if I will.
Yep.
So when you look at the exact drafting of the DMCA, and we need to remember, Congress did the best it could in the 90s with this stuff, but we're no longer in the 90s. And so some of the dynamics that I'm discussing, they're emergent dynamics. They didn't exist in this form in the 90s, and Congress probably couldn't have successfully anticipated some of these dynamics. And to the extent that Congress anticipated them, if you look at the exact drafting of the DMCA, for example, there's a section, section 1201I, which specifically contemplates a consumer's right to know what is happening with his or her data flows inside of systems. And so Congress tried to address this. It was actually, if memory serves, Ashcroft who proposed supported this drafting shift. There is a provision that has never been interpreted by courts and never expanded upon by the Copyright Office, which expressly states that a consumer's ability and desire to know how privacy dynamics are happening with respect to the code, an act of defeating a copy protection mechanism for purposes of uncovering a problem in the way that the code is handling the information in a way when it's contrary to the stated privacy or security promises of that company, that act of uncovering this problematic code behavior, that's something that Congress thought about, not in exactly those words, but that's where they were going if you take a look at 1201I. But unfortunately, that provision has never been given legs. It's never been elaborated upon or strengthened in practice. And we have an imbalance that's evolved across time between other sections of the statute and the spirit behind that section. And so what's happened is that the offensive use of the DMCA has blossomed, but the defensive use of the DMCA, which Congress clearly contemplated if you read it precisely, that part of it has not blossomed. And so the attempt here is really to recalibrate that originally intended balance that Congress tried to instill in the DMCA. But going back to your question, the reason that some companies don't want to hear from security researchers is pretty straightforward if one places oneself in a mindset driven by short-term results. So the same way as every general counsel will explain that sometimes convincing companies that preventative measures are a good idea, it's the same problem here. Fixing code is, in essence, a preventative measure. It is a way to correct something that's already out in the market, that already is shipped, has been, in theory, built to completion. And it's not, in the opinion of these decision makers, sometimes they view it as moving backwards rather than moving forwards. It is an outlay of corporate capital without a clear defined reward. And so they view it in that short-term perspective. It's not something that generates short-term palpable results on balance sheets quarter to quarter the way that, say, bolstering a marketing budget might. But that analysis, when one steps back and thinks about it in longer-term health of a company's future, as the VW case demonstrates, choosing not to correct errors is not a winning strategy, because at some point, it is inevitable that that information will be known by the market. And as the stock price of VW most recently demonstrates, the market doesn't like surprises of this kind. And so choosing not to correct errors, although in the short term, it may look like the way to bolster corporate earnings and bolster profits for balance sheet purposes, it's actually a losing proposition in the long term, because you are putting your trusted relationships at risk, your market valuation at risk. You are threatening potentially, depending on how the vulnerability manifests itself, you're potentially threatening your own research and development. If it's your corporate network that's been compromised and you've experienced a major data breach that you're trying to hide, do you have any guarantees that your financials are still intact? Your CFO is personally certifying those financials under Sarbanes-Oxley. It is always a better investment in thinking through the fix and correcting the existing problems than it is to roll the dice and hope that the errors and vulnerabilities will never be discovered in the long term. It is a bad judgment call for the health of your enterprise long term to choose not to fix known problems in the integrity of your corporate systems or your products.
Andrea, we're at the unfair portion of the show, which is when I ask questions that you may not have adequate time to answer, because we're looking at about 8 minutes left. Let me ask you this. Well, let me take a step back. There was an article in Wired a few weeks ago. Again, we're recording on September 25th, 2015, where you were quoted a fair amount about this issue and about the DMCA exemption. And the article pointed out that the Environmental Protection Agency, of all entities, has opposed at least some of the requests that would be in line with your proposal for exemptions under DMCA. What's the basis for the EPA to be opposed to research?
Sure. So, to be clear, the EPA did not oppose Class 25. Mm-hmm. They opposed two other classes. And class 25 is the research-only class that I'm lawyer on. The other classes also contained a research component, but reading the EPA's objections, what appears to be a point of concern for the EPA, and who knows if they would write the exact same letter today. They submitted that letter in July, and of course, you know, wait 5 minutes and technology changes our world. But anyway, in July, what the EPA voiced was a set of concerns around the tinkering components that were present in those other proposals. And so the other proposals included a framework or an enhanced discussion of the rights of consumers to analyze and modify the code in the products that they own. Our class 25, went in a slightly different direction, but those classes, as you said, did include a research component as well. So my sense is the EPA was concerned about the ability of individuals who are perhaps tinkering in their garage or operating small businesses to modify emissions testing software to game the system in that way. And so the EPA, I think, had a perspective on its own regulatory space that viewed individual tinkerers as a greater threat to noncompliance with the emissions regulations, that those tinkerers were a more likely threat than the producers of the original code. So I think that's the thinking behind the EPA's objection in July to those other classes that also included research and evaluation for safety purposes. So I think that's what's going on there.
You know, and as you point out, you know, you wonder what the EPA would say now, and I'm curious to ask you because you spoke at a hearing that the Copyright Office had on your request. What was the general tenor of that discussion? And then have you had any discussions, or can you share any information about any changes that you anticipate, or any changes you're aware of given the VW situation?
So the tenor of the copyright hearing that we had on Class 25 was productive exchange where the Copyright Office demonstrated that it was aware of the changed technological reality into which these products, particularly Internet of Things products, are being marketed and sold into. And so I think the Copyright Office has an awareness of the tension that I mentioned at the beginning of our chat today, that copyright law is now potentially sitting at odds with basic consumer protection concerns. And so the kind of questions that they gave us were certainly concerned with the traditional copyright bundle of protected spaces and the intentions of the individuals who might be engaged in this kind of research, and a back and forth around some of the dynamics of what the norms are of disclosures as they happen between researchers and companies. I'm holding out cautious optimism. I think that the Copyright Office recognizes that a changed reality currently exists, and that updating to recognize these security risks in one way or another is most likely required. The proposal was opposed by, in particular, General Motors, who also had two representatives at the hearing. The position of General Motors and other car manufacturers in this case was that their internal security teams do an adequate job of testing for code problems in their cars.
And unless they decide to write bad code, as you mentioned.
Right. Yeah. And that they don't really need external assistance or reports in the way that some other companies certainly have facilitated the process through clear reporting channels on their websites, bug bounties, and extending a receptive, welcoming environment to security researchers. So GM and other code car manufacturers with code in their cars, which is pretty much everyone now, though not Tesla. Tesla did not oppose us. Those car manufacturers, and VW was among them, they opposed any research-specific exemption to the DMCA, at least in the way that we had proposed it. But I'm hopeful that perhaps with the changed circumstances post these disclosures about VW software, that perhaps the automakers will change their views a bit, and I certainly hope that the Copyright Office is following with interest the dynamics of the VW defeat software as they are unfolding in the press.
Andrea Medwishan, professor, Northeastern University School of Law, also visiting research collaborator at Princeton CITP. I probably should have said this up front. I attended a workshop that you did where you ran through this application when it was still in draft form. I probably really should have said this at the beginning. I'm definitely sympathetic to it and support it and hope that it gets granted in full. I absolutely invite you back on the show to continue this discussion. This issue, as you pointed out in the beginning, transcends copyright and really does transcend, I think, the constitutional basis for copyright law, because on a personal level, I fail to see how incentives exist for writing code in cars that, as you point out, all cars have and all cars are going to have. And if the question is the quality of the code, well, then I think we've seen what copyright law allows to happen in the Volkswagen situation. So thank you for joining us today on the show. I look forward to having you back on, and I appreciate you taking the time today.
My pleasure.
So there's a number of guests coming up on Hearsay Culture's schedule as we look into this quarter. We've got a really interesting range of guests coming, including David Brin on Information Flow, Sam Brylowski of the Library of Congress's National Sound Preservation Board, editor of the Association for Recorded Sound Collections Guide to Audio Preservation, as well as several other guests focusing in these areas of information policy, and Mariette Schaake, who's a member of the European Parliament from the Netherlands on democracy and technology in Europe. As I'm recording the show on Friday, September 25th, I do not yet have the air time for the show, except to say that it will be on almost every week through the fall quarter, and it will air on KZSU-FM Stanford first before it becomes a podcast. If you want to listen to the show via podcast, you have a couple of ways you can do it. You can go to the iTunes page for Hearsay Culture by going to the CIS iTunes page at Stanford. You can also go to the CIS website at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or you can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 245 previous shows as well as the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com or by going to the contact page on hearsayculture.com, where you can send me information directly. With that in mind, the last thing I will say for this quarter is that I am making a strong effort to attempt to publicize the show in as expeditious way as possible. But for the first time ever, I'm kind of reaching out to listeners and suggesting that if anyone has an interest in volunteering to help out on the show, I would welcome it. And by volunteer, I really mean some kind of internship where you can help me on the back end involving the website. I've written about this on occasion, but to make a long story short, I love doing the show, but it takes a tremendous amount of time because, as hopefully is evident from my questions, I read the book or the writings of our guests, but you are hearing from everyone from the booker to the engineer to the post-production editor to the website admin. It's me. I am extremely grateful for the help I get from Stanford and particularly Elaine Adolfo, who posts the show on CIS's end at Stanford. I am also grateful, of course, to the volunteer redesigner of the webpage, William Monner, and a former Elon student, Brandon Fry, who's now graduated and having a lot of success in the field as a part, in part because of the great work he did on Hearsay Culture. But if you are interested in volunteering as an intern or know someone who might be interested, please do email me at dave@hearsayculture.com or go to the contact page. All right, that's the show for today. Welcome to the new quarter. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.